Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of the Democratic National Convention. And we're delighted to be with you to take a lot of phone calls about a number of issues. The schedule, in case you don't have it down yet, for the next 2 weeks, On Point is going to be live from Denver this week and next week live from Minneapolis for the first hour of our program. And then at 10 o'clock each day, we'll be live from Wisconsin talking with political analysts. Some are from Wisconsin. And to politicians about what's unfolding at the Democratic National Convention and the Republican Convention. So those of us who are true political junkies will be watching coverage on and on and on all week and listening to the convention speakers and then talk about it the next day. And we welcome your phone calls, as always. I would think we'll have many as we, for the first time, really, well, we not for the first time. We've been tuned into this for a long time, 19 months probably. But Americans are now really tuning into this for the first time. The first hour of our program today, we will give you a chance to think about the choice of Senator Joe Biden as Obama's vice presidential running mate and what you thought of that decision and how it was handled at the old State House in Springfield, Illinois. Our guest is from Mental Floss Magazine, which is this wonderful, relatively new magazine. And their cover story this week is The Wildest Rides to the White House. They look at a number of different races, John Adams versus Thomas Jefferson in 1800, in which the rhetoric really flew and some mighty nasty things were said about each candidate. We'll talk about John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson from 1828. Was it indeed the nastiest contest in American history? Did you know that Lyndon Johnson kept his brother Sam under house arrest leading up to the 1964 election? And we'll ask the question whether or not Edgar Allan Poe died from voter fraud. Your phone calls are always welcome as we speak with Jennifer Drapkin, who's senior editor of Mental Floss Magazine. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, as we all keep up with the latest developments. Jennifer, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. So you're going to be glued to television and radio all week, just like the rest of us are. I know. I love it. I go from the Olympics to the conventions. What more can you ask for from life? Let's start with the developments over the weekend and, of course, the big announcement in Springfield, Illinois. I love the fact that it was in Springfield because I love Abraham Lincoln, that Joe Biden was the pick. What did you think about it? Is it a good one?
I think he's a great pick. He's incredibly safe. He fills in a lot of the gaps in Obama's resume. But I think history has been more footnoted than made this weekend. I have a feeling that in a year from now, we're not going to be talking about Joe Biden very much, no matter what happens, whether if Obama wins, he'll be a VP, but he'll be sort of in the background, maybe as an elder advisor, but he's going to be no Dick Cheney in terms of his level of involvement. And if Obama loses, we won't be talking about Joe Biden at all. So It's I feel as though he was a safe choice, and Obama, you know, has done well, but he could have made a more bold decision.
And what would that have been? What would have been bold?
Anyone who wasn't an old white male would have been bolder, but he went with a more traditional choice, I think it's definitely going to help him win the election. But it wasn't for a man who's advocating so much change. It really wasn't a change.
Papers now, the analysts that you're hearing, there seems to be a shift in tone. The New York Times this morning talking about a sudden uneasiness among Democrats that Obama was up in the polls significantly just a month ago. It looks like it's a neck-and-neck race. What are your thoughts about why that's the case, and if there is something that everybody from Barack Obama to Michelle Obama to Ted Kennedy, Caroline Kennedy, everybody can do this week to make those numbers a little higher when you compare him with McCain than they have been the last month?
Well, there was so much excitement during the primary season. People were so involved. And I think that's why his numbers were so much higher then, or at least they seemed to be. And the Republicans didn't have that going for them. There wasn't a tight race going on. There wasn't. People weren't involved in the same way. And I think all that has to happen for his numbers to go back up is for people to start getting excited again and to start realizing that they need to fight for something. Because that's what Obama had going for him during the primary season. His supporters were fighting for something real. And I think they're going to start to feel that way again once the things get kicked off at the convention. And I think, you know, poll numbers go up and down over the course of the months, and I feel like people are very nervous right now, but there's no real reason for it. Nothing that much has changed.
Mm-hmm. One of the commentators on Tom Ashbrook's show, The First Hour, was talking about this guy is a master at inspiration. What we now need to see is a guy who can master the presidency, that you look at him as he gives his speech and you say, he's the president, he's presidential. I don't know what you do to change that from being inspirational to being presidential. Was this commentator right on the money with this, do you think?
I don't think so. He's so dignified as it is. And he may seem inexperienced at this moment, or he may seem like he's unpresidential in some way, but that term has been so loosely defined throughout the years, what it means to be presidential. A lot of his people who are criticizing him say he's not enough an attack dog, or he's not vicious enough, he's not enough of a fighter. But historically speaking, that's not what presidential candidates have done for the first 200 years. Well, quite 200 years, 150 years. The presidents were running for office. They didn't really talk about themselves. They didn't give big speeches in front of audience attacking the other candidate. That's not, they let their minions do that. That's what minions were for, to do your dirty work for you. And it's kind of what Obama's doing. And I think it's an intelligent choice in Joe Biden to let him do a lot of the nastier work for him. And traditionally speaking, that's what presidents do. So I think his sort of dignity and classiness is very presidential. If he maintains that, I think he's going to do wonderfully in the next month.
You know, every now and then you get a statistic that you find just flabbergasting, Jennifer. And over the weekend, I was looking at one of these polls about Biden, and over 50% of the American public didn't know who the guy was. I'm thinking, where in the world are you living?
Well, they have trouble putting the United States on a map. They don't know where they're living.
Yes.
You know, it's not fair, you know. But that is kind of what I mean by, and then we're not going to know who Joe Biden is in 4 months from now. That's the truth, that for the most part, people aren't going to be particularly interested in him, and they probably never will be, unless by some horrible tragedy, President Obama is shot. It's, you know, that's when we start paying attention to vice presidents. And that's what I mean. He's a safe choice. He's going to be in the background. Sometimes he'll be wagging his tail a little bit, but other than that, we're not going to really get to know Joe Biden very much.
Mm-hmm. Except he does have that compelling story. Obama on Saturday referred to the fact that he was Catholic at least several times, trying to reach out to that vote. Working class guy, Scranton, Pennsylvania, fighter for the firefighters, fighter for the cops. You know, that whole image that seems to, and those voters that seem to have escaped Obama, they're trying to count on Biden to pick those up, right?
Sure, of course. I mean, he's got the sort of scruffier working class background, and he's had a rough life. He lost his wife and his daughter.
Terrible, yeah. But
that's right now. That's today. That's what they're focusing on today in the media, because they just made the announcement. But I guess my larger point is that he's not going to be a focus of attention very much in the months to come. People are going to go back to looking at Obama and McCain, and that's just because the announcement was just made.
Right.
If he'd made if he'd gone with a less traditional choice, people might be talking about it more in the months to come. But I don't think that's what Obama wants. I think Obama wants people to be focused on Obama, and that's very intelligent. He has so much going for him. I don't think you'd want a distracting vice presidential choice. He wants. You know, that's why I think in many ways Senator Clinton was never really going to be the nominee, because she would have distracted from the candidate.
Mm.
And Joe Biden's not going to do that.
Right.
He will be very much the second, in the, as he probably should be.
Yeah.
People don't really elect vice presidents.
The magazine certainly reminds us, when we look at nasty elements of the current campaign, that some of these campaigns, oh my gosh, they were darned nasty, weren't they?
Yes. I would go ahead and say that they're nastier than our present campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get away with certain things nowadays. You can't call a president's wife a slut.
No, it's not good.
But that used to be just fine. You really could get away with just about anything. John Quincy Adams was called a pimp. I mean, that was a serious attack against him, that he pimped for the Tsar of Russia, which is completely ridiculous. He introduced the Tsar of Russia to a nice young woman, but not exactly pimping. But you really used to be able to say anything, and it would get published. Newspapers, especially in the 1700s and 1800s, were much more partisan than they are now. You had your one party newspaper, another party newspapers. In fact, many of the parties were organized around newspapers. So you could get away with calling the other guy anything you wanted to call him, and there really didn't have to be much truth behind it. Nowadays, we have a lot more access to the media, and that means we have a lot more access to information, and people do eventually check the facts. Maybe it takes 20 years, but eventually you wind up hearing more or less the truth about people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's less of a tendency to just frankly make things up, although it certainly still happens.
Let's go back to that 1800 campaign. Jefferson hires a hatchet man, John Adams versus Thomas mm-hmm. Jefferson, and the guy he hired, James Callender. What James did and what happened to James eventually?
James Callender was an amazing figure. I guess he you could call him the Karl Rove of the 1800s. He was a strategist. He knew exactly what to say to get people upset, and he also knew how to get information. So he did Thomas Jefferson's dirty work for him. He published nasty things about John Adams, and John Adams thought he was above such tactics. John Adams would have never hired a man to do that, and of course he wound up losing the election. But James Callender wrote some very vicious things about John Adams. I want to give one quote here because I kind of love it. He wrote that President Adams had a hideous hermaphroditical character which has neither the force or firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. He called the president a hermaphrodite in so many words. And we don't do that so much anymore.
No.
And at the time, the Alien and Sedition Acts had been passed, and Callender wound up going to jail for making slanderous remarks against the president. And he knew this was going to happen. This was something that was fairly obvious. So he served 8 months in prison for Thomas Jefferson. And when he got out, he felt that now President Jefferson owed him a great deal. And Jefferson gave him something like $50 in return for his services when he got out of prison. And Callender just thought that wasn't anywhere near what he deserved. So he went and started attacking Thomas Jefferson. It's really how you need to be careful who you have on your side, because they can turn against you. And what's interesting about how he attacked Thomas Jefferson is he probably was writing the truth or something very close to it. He's the one who broke the Sally Hemings story.
Hmm.
He wrote that Jefferson had an affair with Hemings in France and that she had fired 5 of his children. And it was incredibly scandalous and salacious. And, people were extremely upset. It plagued Jefferson until he died. But what's interesting is that historians didn't believe Callender's stories, and they didn't credit that story until fairly recently when DNA evidence came out in the 90s saying that there's a definite genetic leak between Sally Hemings' descendants and Thomas Jefferson, and there's a very good chance that he fathered many of her children. So Callender lied so much during the course of his lifetime that when he actually told the truth about a president, historians didn't believe him. but that having been said, there's a very good chance that if Thomas Jefferson hadn't hired Callender in the first place, we might not be talking about Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
Isn't that a story?
Never,
That's a great story. And flip ahead to 1828, when what we learned from that election, ever since Jackson's decisive victory, no presidential candidate has dared to take a step toward the White House without first holding hands with a common man. Why is that?
Well, it is interesting, right? Because you have Obama bowling, and you kind of wonder, why is Obama bowling? What a silly thing for him to do, and why was Hillary Clinton talking about shooting with her granddaddy
right
in the backyard when she has been anti-gun her whole life? Why are they doing this? The answer to that is Andrew Jackson, who was the first president who was really a man of the people. He grew up dirt poor. Everyone in his family was dead by the time he was 13. He'd been abused and abandoned and left to fend for himself. And by the time he was 15, he was just roaming the streets of South Carolina, stealing outhouses for fun. That was what his childhood was like. It was rough and dirty and grimy and sad. Everyone just kept dying for him. But he was incredibly popular with the people because he was a war hero, and he was strong, and he was virile, and he survived an entire campaign against the Indians on nothing but acorns. And the person he was running against was John Quincy Adams, who couldn't have had... He had the most privileged childhood of any politician, really, ever running for office. By the time he was 14 or 15 years old, he had already traveled all throughout Europe with his father on diplomatic missions to France and to Amsterdam. And he was serving, by the time he was 15, he was serving as a court translator for the Tsar of Russia. That's an incredible first job, really. Most people
sure
are supposed to eat hamburgers.
He was
a court translator and having a fantastic time. And he was Harvard educated. He was everything that you could want in an incredible childhood he had, and from a prominent family. And in 1824, which is the election before 1828, he ran against Andrew Jackson and won, sort of, maybe, kind of. It was one of those elections that had to be, no one got a majority, so it had to be decided in the House of Representatives, and there was Henry Clay threw his support behind Adams at the last minute, and in the end, he wound up winning, but it was very fishy. Clay got a Secretary of State appointment out of it, and Adams was labeled a usurper for 4 years. So when 1828 came around, and the American people had the chance to elect Andrew Jackson again, they were so excited. They hated John Adams by that time, John Quincy Adams. They absolutely hated him. And so as the election proceeded, things got dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. And yes, John Quincy Adams was called a pimp, and Andrew Jackson's wife was called a bigamist, actually, which was technically speaking true, because she had accidentally, they hadn't filed the paperwork on her divorce from her husband by the time she married Andrew Jackson, but, you know, she wasn't really a bigamist in the sense that she had two husbands for 20 years or something like that. And things got so violent and so tense between the two of them that Rachel Jackson actually had a heart attack and died before Andrew took office, and he was heartbroken for the rest of his life, really. But it was such an intense experience in the country that for the first time, more than a million people voted because they had a chance to elect one of their guys. And ever since then, candidates have not been able to ignore the fact that they need to seem like a man of the people. John Quincy Adams was definitely labeled an elitist. But as it turns out, losing that election was probably the best thing that ever happened to him. He had been a sort of miserable president. He'd never been able to really rally support around his ideas. But when he went back to Massachusetts after losing, somehow he sort of mustered up some courage to run for the House of Representatives. And if you think about it, going from president to,
really?
To congressman, it's a pretty big deal. It's sort of humbling in a way. But once he was in the House of Representatives, he got to really come alive. He became like his father as we were leading up to independence. He was able to, you know, use his voice and rally support around his thoughts and ideas. And he became an abolitionist hero. He is sort of responsible in many ways for lifting the gag rule, which had been placed in Congress to forbid speech against were about the topic of slavery. Slavery was so controversial at the time they didn't even want to talk about it. It was banned from the floor of debate. And he spent 17 years basically getting that rule lifted so that the debate on slavery could open up. He fought passionately and became a hero. So it is interesting when you look back at these elections. He, in some ways, he was sort of the Al Gore at the time. You know, by losing the election, he was actually able to really figure out who he was and what he believed in, and have a great impact in the world. So it's interesting. Losing the election isn't always losing. Sometimes it's just a way to get people to notice you.
Right. Phone calls for you in just a moment, Jennifer. Jennifer Drapkin is our guest. She is the senior editor of Mental Floss magazine. Their cover story is really interesting. It's always an interesting magazine. The Wildest Rides to the White House, and we're talking about that. And also, of course, looking at what's happened over the weekend and the start of the Democratic National Convention, what Obama has to do to make people more confident that he's ready to lead the country, while the polls have shown that this is a pretty close race. Some of the people you're most looking forward to hearing from this week, I understand Ted Kennedy, he's a strong soul, isn't he, has arrived in Denver and evidently will be speaking tonight. There will be a tribute to the Kennedy family this evening. Michelle Obama will be speaking. I'll be sitting. I'm glued on this. I got to tell you, I'm glued on it. I sit there and watch hour after hour after hour after hour. And my family says, haven't you seen enough? And I say, no, no. So let's welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. The schedule for this week and next, On Point, is live from Denver, the first hour of our program at 9 o'clock, and next week from St. Paul. So for the first hour, Tom Ashbrook will be with you with a number of different guests. And then at 10, we'll be live from Wisconsin getting your response to all that's going on. To your calls in a moment. Mimi Notstein is on air producing for us today, so you'll chat with Mimi, and we'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Jennifer and start with Scott from Appleton. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Fascinating story. I've heard some of them before, and makes you realize that the nasty campaigns of today are nothing compared to what they were back then.
Right.
I just had a quick comment about Joe Biden, and I think it was a poor choice on Fox, because if this is a change election, which all the pundits have been saying, there's nothing about change with Joe Biden. He's been in the Senate longer than he's been out of the Senate. I think it was not a bold move on his part. I think it accents Obama's weaknesses, the guy that 4 years ago was in the House Senate. And that's my point. And I guess my question also is why haven't we heard the gravitas term? 8 years ago, we heard that incessantly about George Bush when he picked Dick Cheney, about how this was adding gravitas to George. I mean, you heard it every time you turned the television on, and it was a point made about George Bush's weaknesses. But we don't hear that now, and I'm kind of surprised by that.
It's interesting. I do remember gravitas was the catchphrase of 8 years ago. I guess part of the reason we were hearing it so much is that people really doubted that George Bush himself had gravitas, because he'd never really, you know, proven himself as to be a leader before, and you know, he spent so many years working on baseball, you know. And I think part of the reason we're not hearing that now is because Obama has his own gravitas. I mean, people do take him seriously, even if they say he's inexperienced. They think that he has sort of a noble bearing, as it were. He has his own sense of I don't want to say self-importance, but he's a sense of importance. He knows what he's doing and why he's doing it. But it is interesting. The only reason, and I don't totally disagree with you that this may have been a poor choice. It certainly wasn't an exciting choice. But I just think if you look at this, you know, the sort of the past presidential histories, it's very difficult for a vice president really to have an impact on the election. They have to do something scandalous and ridiculously stupid for them to really affect anything. And even then, you sort of look at them and think, well, was that really why they lost? Probably not. Because at the end of the day, we don't elect vice presidents. We elect presidents, and attacking the VP is, in some ways, people think it's sort of a silly thing to do, because this is a body double, really. This is a person who probably have no impact on history unless, of course, they have all the impact in the world, but if they become president. But I think that when, you know, right now, sure, we're going to be talking about Joe Biden a lot, but in a couple months, the campaigns are both going to be refocused, and it's just going to be Obama versus McCain. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to decide this election, is how people feel about the two of them.
Scott, thanks for the call. Let's go to another Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Another wonderful program. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I would like to ask your guest to comment a little bit on fascinating to me anyway election, which was the one where we actually elected Tilden as president. But the election was stolen by Rutherford B. Hayes, as he became known, in a disputed electoral vote count in, guess what's coming, Florida. I think that was 1876. I'm hoping she will correct me if I have any of the details wrong, but I just love that story.
Yes, it's an amazing story. In many ways, I think that was the dirtiest campaign of all time, except for the fact that the two candidates themselves weren't that dirty. Both Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes, as he became known, we're pretty honest guys. That's why their parties had nominated them. It had been a time of corruption in American history. There had just been so many scandals. The Republicans had been in office, I think, for 16 years, and that at that time, Republican meant Party of Lincoln. It was not exactly that well closely related to the modern day Republican Party, scandal after scandal had just been coming out in the party, and that's why they picked Rutherford B. Hayes as their candidate, because he was innocuous, he was a stand-up guy, he loved his family, he was just a good old, you know, he was a good old guy, you know, he sweet, really. Samuel Tilden, the Democrat from New York, he was known for rooting out corruption in the state of New York, and he was also a very much a stand-up guy. And so what's interesting about this election, which wound up being the most corrupt election of all time, because it wasn't really decided in any way by the voters, is that the two candidates had very little to do with what happened. It was all party henchmen in the middle of the night changing things. On the election evening, both Tilden and Hayes went to bed believing Tilden had been elected president. There were three states that were contested. I know Florida was one of them. I think the other was Louisiana. And I know Oregon had one vote that was sort of weird, one electoral vote that was off. And I can't remember the third state. But they were slightly contested. And if it turned out by some miracle that Hayes had carried all three, then yes, by one electoral vote, he would be president. But you know, no one thought that was going to happen. And it turns out in the middle of the night, the party operatives got on the telegraph and started making trouble in the states, and getting ballots thrown out and lost, quote unquote. They weren't really lost. There's almost no doubt that Tilden really won the election, but his party operatives, Hayes's party operatives, were so good at creating at least confusion that the election went to the House of Representatives and to the Senate, actually, to both, because they couldn't figure out exactly what to do in the case of a completely botched election. Our Constitution didn't really cover that at the time. What do we do if we just can't count the votes? Was not part of the Constitution. That's what I find to be the most amusing part of it, because our founding fathers never thought it would come to what if we're just not capable of counting. things didn't go well in the House and the Senate, so they wound up forming this weird committee that also had a few Supreme Court justices. So it was five senators, five people from the House of Representatives, and five Supreme Court justices. And that's this committee of 15. I mean, this was all ridiculous. Like, none of this was in the Constitution. It was all getting made up as they went along. Decided the election. And it had eight Republicans and seven Democrats, and so the Republicans won. And that's how that election was decided. It was ludicrous. And Hayes, who was not himself a corrupt guy, wound up having this presidency where he could do nothing because his whole presidency, he was called his fraudulency and Rutherford B. Hayes, and the usurper. And that was, you know, that was history at that mm-hmm. time. And the pitiable thing about it is the way that compromise was made, where the decision was made to give him the election meant giving up Reconstruction in the South, mm-hmm. and that's what started the Jim Crow laws. So it's very sad, actually.
So we got this darn issue of race with us again and again for hundreds mm-hmm. of years. It's too bad, isn't it? We should be over that by now. I think.
Well, maybe we will be. I mean, it's the year to do it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Scott, very much for the call. 800-4-866-8655 in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. We're talking about the wildest rides to the White House and also talking about what's going on this week in Denver and having a good old time, and we will this week. The thing that's happening here, we're taking On Point, which is live in Denver. We wish we could be as well, but maybe next time. Tom Ashbrook's show is live from Denver, so we're carrying that the first hour of our program, and then the second hour this week from Denver and next week from St. Paul, having our own analysts and giving you a chance to talk at greater extent about what you've been watching, what you've been observing. Steve from Green Bay is next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a comment for your guest, Jennifer. She seemed very insightful, but I just have one comment on a comment she made about maybe if Obama had made a bold statement by selecting somebody maybe of color, I'm not sure that would have been a good idea because of the 12% of the Democrats that kind of voted against Obama because of color of skin. That translates to, 2 million people? That'd be like a little bit of a suicide for Obama. I think America is ready for change, maybe 80-90%. But that 10% that he's trying to reach, that I think Biden was an excellent choice. For me, it seems, you know, it's like having a foreign exchange student, welcoming them in your home, and they show up, and they bring three or four relatives with them, say, oh, by the way, they're staying too. I think that would be a little bit daunting for America's not ready maybe for to people of color, you know, as far as running the White House. America, for the most part, is ready for change, but maybe slowly. I think Obama will win the presidency, but his choice of Biden is I think it's an excellent choice, and I'll take my comment out there.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, what about this? They were talking about it the first hour here, too, that there would be 2% at least of Democrats who would not vote for a person of color, which I find hard to believe. But in this kind of election, it could make a huge difference unless Obama widens the gap. Can you comment on that?
I find it interesting. I also think that people say something like that. They you know, that's maybe their gut or something. But when they actually get into the voting booth and there's no one around, and they look at the future of the country and what's happening, they're going to pick the candidate who they feel can guide the country. And if they don't, if they're not lined up with a candidate's ideals, they're not going to vote for them. I feel as though you know, if even if you're incredibly racist, if you don't believe in what McCain stands for, you're not going to vote for him. You may not vote at all, and that is definitely a possibility. But it's Kennedy. You know, they were saying basically the same things about him. People aren't going to vote for a Catholic, you know. But then they did, and I think it's a matter of getting Obama out there, showing what he can do. And people may find themselves overcoming their racism when they're alone, when they're just in the voting booth making their decision. And 2%, could he win by more than 2%? Could he cover that margin? Absolutely. That is completely a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think McCain has a real uphill battle because of the state of the economy and because of the really scandalous and awful presidency of the last 8 years. And so I think 2% is not too much of a spread for Obama to cover, even with what the polls are saying right now. Things go up and down.
Yeah, interesting. Let's go to the, we all remember these lines, Mama, where's my pa? And eventually went to Mama, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha. Grover Cleveland and James Blaine, and I'm not sure it would have played out the same way if John Edwards had been the nominee, right?
maybe not.
No.
I mean, John Edwards, that's an old story. We've heard that story many times before. I guess maybe the lesson from Mama, Where's My Pa, and then the retort, that came, sorry, just to give a little context, Mama, Where's My Pa was Blaine supporters back in the election of Grover Cleveland versus Blaine came up with that clever little ditty after it came out that Grover Cleveland may have fathered an illegitimate child. And then when eventually Blaine lost, as he did, that's why we don't know about President Blaine, the retort was, Mama, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha. And really, I think the most important lesson from that is that if your candidate has a campaign slogan, make sure that there isn't some alternative slogan that rhymes that will make you look foolish.
Right.
The same thing happened, actually. I like this a lot. Barry Goldwater versus Richard Nixon, versus Lyndon Johnson. Barry Goldwater's campaign slogan was, in your heart, you know he's right.
Right.
In your heart, you know he's right, which doesn't rhyme. I'm just going to point that out. But in response, the Johnson Democrats came up with, in your guts, you know he's nuts, which I think is really nice to describe
right.
Barry Goldwater.
Right.
In your guts, you know he's nuts. It's so good, you know? These little ditties that come across over time. It's really kind of remarkable the way these slogans can stick over the years.
Right.
But you just have to hire good henchmen is really what that's all about, to come up with these things for you. Sometimes they wind up having these pangs of consciousness afterwards, but usually not.
Well, welcome. More phone calls. Jennifer Dropkin is our guest, senior editor for Mental Floss magazine. Their cover story is The Wildest Rides to the White House. We've been talking about some of those and interweaving our conversation with what we're expecting from the Democrats in Denver this week. Welcoming phone calls. Our lines are quite filled right now, but keep trying. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee, or send an email if you'd like, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jennifer Dropkin is our guest this hour, and she's senior editor of Mental Floss magazine. Let me just ask you what you're most looking forward to tonight. I think it's astounding that Ted Kennedy made his way to Denver. It's going to be an extremely moving tribute to him, I'm sure. The audience is going to be in tears, and then he's going to be there as well. It will be quite a moment, don't you think?
Oh, I think it could absolutely be a fantastic moment, and it could get people excited and get their emotions turned on to be elected again. I think it's going to be a great convention overall. But it's not. It's interesting because I think our expectations for what a convention can be have been somewhat lowered over the years because we haven't had a ridiculous convention where everything went wrong in a very long time, at least not since 1968. It's going to be, I think, a smooth ride, a good PR campaign for the Democrats overall. But it's one of those things where if you look at the sort of recent history of campaigns, our short-term memory is basically or long-term memory, rather, is non-existent. And I always get a little nervous when I see these things because it's a matter of keeping momentum up for months and months and months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have momentum for this month, you know, because of the well-thought-out, I think, Democratic convention. But then, you know, what's going to happen a month from now is going to be much more important in terms of actually determining who becomes president. And then 2 months from now, it really is a matter of sustaining momentum for a very long time.
Right.
And also weathering the fact that things are going to go up and down. So I am, you know, I'm sure it's going to be a great speech tonight. But I'm not expecting any big surprises for the next week, because I think that they sort of know better than to have a big surprise. Because, and a lot of this is because I think of the race issue. It's a big enough issue on its own. They don't need anything else. You know, it both gets people excited and makes people nervous. I think that the rest of it's just about getting things to run smoothly. And I have a feeling it will for definitely the next week.
I think Michelle Obama is a fabulous speaker. She'll be speaking tonight. Does she have to accomplish some kind of task this evening?
Oh, she's marvelous. And you know, she just has to be the intelligent, supportive, beautiful woman that she is. And there's, I think and will be in the next few months prove to be a fantastic asset. And I think that's something that sort of gets forgotten in the pages of history, that even more so than VPs, the wife of the president during campaign season or the presumptive nominee can do incredible things for someone's image. LBJ, you know, basically owed so much to Lady Bird during many campaigns, but especially when he was running for president. She made campaign speeches for him and won enormous support for him in the South, because she had that image. And I think Michelle Obama can do that for Barack in terms of women, getting women who are disappointed that, you know, Hillary Clinton isn't the nominee, excited again, because Barack Obama is definitely, you know, a man who has a wife who is an equal. They have a very modern relationship. She's not some, you know, cookie-cutting wife in the background. She's a real person in her own right, and I think that she will actually play a bigger role in the next few months than Joe Biden.
Interesting. Teresa from Viroqua. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I'm just loving the history, but I disagree that Biden was a safe choice. I think he was really the bold choice, and the reason I feel that way is that I think it's kind of foolish to think that change is really going to happen by bringing in a whole bunch of new people and fresh faces and with minimal experience. And, you know, Obama is extremely wise, and he does see things from a pragmatic standpoint and knows what needs to be done. And I think Biden was definitely the bold choice because he needs a partner that has that inside experience. You've got to work from the inside out. You can't just work from the outside in. And it is reaching his hand across the aisle, so to speak. I mean, he knew he was going to get criticized for this, and he knew he was going to hear a bunch of pundits saying, yeah, you know, he's copping out. But if he really wants to make change, and he really does, Biden was the excellent choice. He is an inside Washington type, but he's about as outside of Washington as you can get. You know, he goes home every night. He's the poor man's man, you know, he really connects with the little guy, and with his wealth of experience and expertise in foreign policy and just in legislation in general, Obama's going to need that, and he's wise enough to put aside the criticism and say, okay, this is the wise choice, and I do think it was the bold choice. And my other comment is, I think that you're right on when you're talking about sustaining the momentum, and I think that Obama's really just been holding back and holding back and holding back because he's smart, and he knows he can only keep, you know, the excitement going for so long, and it starts to wear people out. And so he's holding back on it until after the convention, and then, you know, it's just kind of the lull before the storm right now, and then things are really going to just break wide open in that final sprint. And I think it's the smart way to go if you want to win the election, because you just can't keep, you know, you just
going for 19 months.
Right, exactly.
It's a long time.
Exactly. You know, by allowing this lull over the month of August, just letting McCain, I mean, look what McCain has done. He's been pompous, he's been arrogant, he's been sarcastic, he's been rude, you know, because he's getting kind of too fat and sassy and really not watching his back. And he's made a lot of stupid moves, and he's also thrown everything at Obama, including the kitchen sink, that he could, and now he's not going to have anything left when it gets down to the end of the wire. And I think that's been very wise on Obama's part, too. So those are my comments.
Thank you. Wise comments, I think they are. Jennifer.
I would like to say that I think the way Obama has played announcing his VP has been very intelligent, you know, with the mystery and saving it to the last minute and sending that in text messages to his supporters. And that's a good way to sustain momentum, you know, just keep a little secret as long as you can. I think part of the reason I'm not as excited about Joe Biden is because I just know from having, you know, read all this stuff about vice presidents and the history of nominations that they so rarely have an impact. And the reason there's no way of knowing, you know, until Obama is in the White House exactly what role Joe Biden is going to play. But usually they don't play a role at all, vice presidents, even when they're older and wiser. The one big exception to this is Dick Cheney.
Oh, yes.
If you sort of look at Dick Cheney's role in the Bush empire over the years, he's always been a player. He's always been a prominent figure. To think that he would get into the White House and still be playing a big role makes sense. That's logical. He was an older, wiser advisor for a very long time, whereas Joe Biden and Obama don't have that sort of relationship. So will they have that relationship once they get into the White House? It's possible. Mm-hmm. But historically speaking, it's unlikely. He'll probably just fall into the background, and he's 65 years old. That's a good time to retire, and being a vice president is a good way to retire. You don't do very much. He could be a big role. It's definitely possible. He definitely has the capacity for it. But it's just not what tends to happen. They tend to fall into the background.
Thanks so much for the call, Teresa. So what do you think? What side of history do you fall on? Did Edgar Allan Poe die from voter fraud?
It's so
That's
hard
quite
to
a
tell.
Story.
He could have died from so many things. He was such a drug addict and was in love with his cousin. I mean, who knows what he died from? But it is definitely possible. Edgar Allan Poe's body was found a couple days after the election, maybe the day after the election of 1849. He was beaten up, drunk, wearing another man's clothing, but also inside of a bar that had been a polling booth. And polling station. You might wonder, what is that? You know, how does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
At the time, there was a practice called cooping, and really, we have much more gentle elections than we used to. Cooping was this practice where you'd get some poor guy, beat him up, get him drunk, and then shift him around from polling station to polling station, and make him vote many times, and beat him up some more, and get him drunk. And sometimes you would make him change clothing so he could go to the same station more than once to vote. And this may have been what happened to Edgar Allan Poe. If he had just been found beaten up and drunk, then it could be assumed that he was just drunk. But he was found wearing another man's clothing. And so it is a logical explanation for why he was found where he was found doing what he was doing. He wasn't quite dead when they found him. He went to the hospital for a few days and then died, but he never woke up to tell his tale. I do love the fact that he has a strange, mysterious death. It's so fitting. He may have died of voter fraud.
Isn't that something? And I didn't know that LBJ had the Secret Service keep his brother under house arrest at the White House because...
Yeah.
He had a habit of getting drunk, and then reporters would ply him with questions.
I think if you're a president, there's a rule that you have to have at least one immediate family member who's
right.
an alcoholic.
Right.
Whether you're dad, children, siblings. And in LBJ's case, it was his brother. The journalists in Washington knew this, so they liked to take Sam Johnson out, get him drunk, and then ask him for secrets or, you know, information about LBJ. And it apparently worked really well. LBJ kept his younger brother under house arrest during the election season so that he couldn't get drunk with reporters. And historically speaking, of presidents are often trouble. Jimmy Carter's brother.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Carter. Yeah, he was, in his own description, a redneck with white socks and a blue ribbon beer, which is really classy. He would pee publicly in front of reporters. He was always drunk, and they never really did a good job of keeping him under wraps. He probably should have been under house arrest. And during the 1980 election, he just was a big scandal. He took $200,000 worth of loans from Libya to campaign on behalf of his brother. It was a disaster. He was a disastrous younger brother. It's a rough time.
Yeah, hard to believe the two of them were related. Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us. Have fun watching all the election coverage this week.
I will.
I will, too. I can't wait. Thanks. Jennifer Drapkin, senior editor of Mental Floss magazine. And I should tell you that the cover is The Wildest Rides to the White House. It's a very entertaining issue. We've talked about many of the stories, but of course there are more. What's happening this week is On Point is live from Denver for the Democrats and live from St. Paul for the Republicans next week. And then we'll be with you at 10 o'clock to have our own analysts and give you a chance to talk about what you saw and heard the previous day. So that should be fun. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show. Mimi Notestein for on-air production. Until tomorrow.